Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
June 23, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for with the mic that is running just a little too hot. We'll bring that down. How do I know that this is the show you were looking for? Because you have found the O'Shelly Effect. Anyway, we are live here on a Thursday, second to last broadcast day of the week for my show usually, but I took some days off this week for a couple of different reasons. And we'll get into that, and we'll get into the special project, which is going to be released right along with this podcast tomorrow. So we'll release that on Friday along with this show, and obviously the show that preceded me on the live network, the Jack Blood 360 show. So what do we on Thursday nights? Happily, we usually have Michael Swanson in the first hour, and tonight, yes indeed, he is back once again. Now, he's gone away taking breaks and this and that. It's not that he's just sick of me that I know of, but on occasion, Mike has a life, so he has things to do. And, hey, you know, sitting down with me every Thursday, he can do that anytime he wants. So back with us, and glad that he is, and unfortunately, I may have to torture him about some financial stuff, but we'll see where that all goes, because Mike can talk about whatever he wants. Oh, and by the by, he is the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. Of course, the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War, which is one in a series of a planned series of three books on that particular conflict. But he's also authored other books and all that stuff. You'll get the links in the show notes. Second hour, another great author, Larry Hancock, with us. And I know we've been over the topic many a time, but I think Larry has something interesting he wants to talk about regarding the JFK case. So, Larry Hancock, the author of, let's just give a couple of his books out there. How about Surprise Attack, Shadow Warfare, Unidentified, Creating Chaos, Someone Would Have Talked. I didn't even name them all. Anyway, Larry Hancock will be with us in the second hour, and we'll get there as quickly as we can. Because, it's already about 5 minutes deep here. I mean, well, time-wise, I haven't been live that long, but I've already killed like 5 of the minutes that I need to use to get to the show. And going to try and restrict what I have to say tonight because I want to hear from my guests. Oh, one more thing. We have phone lines open. 319-527-5016. 319-527-5016. If you would like to join into the conversation, I'll give both of my rotating and repeat guests the opportunity to talk to you. God help them. Rules, though, okay, not for the Friday night show, because that's pretty much, you know, open country, but here's the thing. You are not allowed to abuse anybody except the host of the show when you call in on a regular call-in night, okay? So that rule stands, 319-527-5016. And I know I already mentioned your website, Mike. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It is not just about Wall Street. Proud sponsor, I think proud anyway, sponsor of this show and the network in general. If you don't know that, then I guess you don't listen to the commercial breaks. But Mike, very happy to have you along with us and to continue to be with us, not just because you're a great author and a smart guy, but because you're just very, very cool about being supportive of the show consistently and the network in general. And you've been very patient with me, Mike. I appreciate you. I really do. So let's get to it. What is on your mind and how are you tonight, Mr. Swanson?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I went on a little vacation for a week and I'm catching up on stuff myself, too. You mentioned the financial markets. I give a little update there, I guess. As we've been talking, I believe it's a real bear market in the stock market, but the Wall Street Journal had an interesting article this morning saying that the individual investors, the regular person in the stock market, has lost about 35% of their money this year. Now, that's a much larger loss than how much the S&P 500 and even the NASDAQ has gone down about it. People, you know, that are really getting hurt that are trading or investing in the financial markets. And the only, you know, I think it's going to continue, but I guess the silver lining that I can tell you right now is that a lot of the commodities have pulled back in the past week. Oil, the food commodities in particular have pulled back. So, for example, corn was over $800 a bushel, and now it's at $650. So that's a nice pullback over a short amount of time. Energy stocks like Exxon and Chevron, they've pulled back, and the price of oil has gone from about 120 to 104. It's not to suggest things are going to get cheap all of a sudden. In fact, you got to watch what you're buying. I went to Food Line the other day and thought I was buying apples. And normally I don't look at the prices because I just buy the same thing every time I'm going in there.
Right.
And then when I got home, I paid $15 for this little thing of apples. I was just shocked. You know,
well, Food Lion, for people that maybe don't, I don't know how popular Food Lion is nationally, but it's a fairly large chain of grocery stores in primarily, I think, in the South, Southeast, actually. And they're sort of the equivalent to, if you're in the Northeast, of a ShopRite. They're very similar in their general quality, the way they handle things, and they're just sort of like the reasonable grocery store. They're not the expensive one, but they're also not the cheap joint. So it's interesting to note that look, you go to one of those sorts of places and you expect, okay, I'm not going to get, you know, the bargain basement price on everything, but I'm also not usually going to get price gouged, and I'm not going to the all-natural food store where, you know, you breathe on something, it costs you $15. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You go to the, like a Fresh Market or a Whole Foods or one of these places with very, very high-quality stuff, I don't know. I haven't actually been in one of those in many months because there was no point. It was out of my price range before the economic situation that we're in now. And the thing is, this does relate to commodities a bit. I don't know how much it relates to the stock market, as I always say, right? It's a bit disconnected from most people. But in the past few years where we've seen the exponential access, right, increase, I mean, the old days of E-Trade and, you know, people literally taking it upon themselves to be like day traders and stuff like that, that sort of went weird, and now it's almost like a gaming app that you can use with Robinhood now, right? Where it's like, oh, well, I can actually just, you know, go on my phone and almost like same time I've got Candy Crush on, you know, I can flip back and forth between Candy Crush and what I got my stocks in, because I can buy little bits of stock in this and that, right?
Well, that's one reason I think that's contributing to people losing so much money. I mean, if you're losing more money than the stock market is falling, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah,
you're a loser. I mean, and that's what most people are doing. And one of the contributing factors to that is the rise of these apps that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And the problem with them is that they make money when you make a trade. That's how they make money, right, from people doing trades. They don't make money if you just put, you know, $500 in there and don't do anything. And they don't make much money if you just make one trade and you're done. They make money the more trades you do. So the very design of the app, and I'll tell you an email they sent, help explain what's going on. The very design of the app encourages people to make a lot of trades. Mm-hmm. And there's very little, really no meaningful information in it you can use to make a decision. What they show you are lists of stuff that other people have bought. So the app encourages people to like herd and just do what other people are doing. And and last year when GameStop and AMC, these things were all in the news, people could buy those, some, you know, those stocks that appear on the list of most owned stocks and climb up the list, and that kind of was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
Now the stocks on the list are all falling, and the actual number of trades people are doing on these things is diminishing because people are shutting their accounts down after wiping out. Oh, they said in the first quarter that 10% of Robinhood customers wiped out, and we won't know what happened this quarter for another couple of weeks, but there's no reason to think it's not another bunch of millions that have been financially devastated to design this thing. But one thing about bear markets is they tend to go through three distinctive psychological phases.
Right.
And the first, most people, you know, are bullish on stocks. They buy stocks and they want them to go up, and the financial media caters to that. And the industry I came out of, which was financial newsletters, which was an industry that really boomed in the 70s, but that's basically what I came out of in the 90s and 2000s. I don't really do it anymore, but that whole industry, what you sell people are predictions or stock picks. That's what people want.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, I don't have anything to, you know, I'm not telling people to buy anything. I just don't see this as a good way to try to make money.
Right.
And so I write these posts saying, come back next year. You know, I'm losing all the trading audience I had, but I just don't really, what can you do?
You're telling people to go fishing at this point because there's just nothing productive.
They go fish. They don't go fishing. They go listen to someone else that gives them the pick.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, Mike, look,
I'm not really doing any good. But anyway, the thing about a bear market is there's three phases, and the first phase is right at the top, and there's practically nobody that's bearish right at the top of the market. You know, everyone's fully invested. It's like a pyramid scheme. If you've ever bought into a pyramid scheme, it's exactly what it's like. To give you an example, where I live, almost 20 years ago, time goes by, someone set up a pyramid scheme, and they got a piece of paper and created these blocks on it. And I didn't buy into this, but they had different business people, a couple political figures, that participated, and it was crazy. Each block cost like $2,000, and you'd buy the sheet. Basically, they're printing the sheets out, and they'd put your name down. You'd give them $2,000, and then if you could go around and sell, you know, enough blocks on your sheet, they would give you like $12,000, or it might have been $20,000. It was a lot of money. And I found out about this on a Wednesday, and people were asking me to get in it. I'm like, I'm not doing that. That's a pyramid scheme. And of course, he said, no, this isn't. This is gifting. Yeah, sure. It's always different. And then
gifting, Ponzi, Amway. Amway is like this too, which is hilarious.
So the next day, though. I had a few people call me on the phone that I knew, you know, asking should they do it, or one of them wanted me to do it, you know, get on their sheet or whatever. So this thing was spreading like crazy. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Outback Steakhouse. I remember this so distinctively.
Right.
And I was sitting at the bar, and I kid you not, while I was there, over a dozen people during like 90 minutes came up to me to try to sell me a spot on their piece of paper.
Right.
And when you go out, you know, to eat somewhere like that, and all these people are coming up to you, I mean, who's left to get in? That the pyramid is complete. So that's what happens in the stock market. In Bitcoin, all these things are all financial markets. And at that moment, though, just like these people told me, oh, this isn't a pyramid, they'll say the stock market or crypto, whatever, this is different. Mm-hmm. This isn't like the past markets that would fall, you know, go in a cycle of a bear market. No, this is completely different. So for the Bitcoin people, we're saying, making this argument that the day will come when Bitcoin will replace all the what they're saying. Like, I think cryptocurrencies are scams and they're all crashing and this and that. But what they were saying, the pure Bitcoin people were making this argument that, look, Bitcoin is not a cryptocurrency. It's unique. It's not a scam. And the day will come in which all the other cryptocurrencies will crash. The dollar will crash. Every currency in the world will crash. And the only thing left will be Bitcoin. Uh-huh. So if you buy it, you will be like owning the monopoly on money. The phrase I'm saying is, the psychology behind this is new. It's called new paradigm. They think this financial instrument or market is all financial history no longer applies because this is a unique situation. In the stock market,
yeah, everybody wants to be the guy who bought Apple at $20 a share. You know what I mean? Everybody wants to be the guy, and I mentioned this before, that they got offered Bitcoin at $80, which I did, and I wouldn't buy it because I was happier buying my silver coins. Because I, you know, but now it's like, oh, you're a fool. Look at what you missed. Same time, though. A lot of people have come and gone, boom and bust on this. And the funny thing is, it reminds me very much of subbing out your football pools, which is a very simple way of creating a system of pools where, yeah, you have other people sell
That's a
whole
sheet. That's a good comparison.
And, yeah, I mean, and there you have something, though. But the funny thing about that is that at the very least, you have something that is not entirely predictable. That, you know, that it's like, no matter how you watch the metrics, any week the Jets might win. And I do say that personally because, you know, maybe. Just like it might, you know, it might indeed rain and snow at the same time in July. You know what I'm saying? It might, but anyway, the Jets, forget it. Point is,
well,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, what? So in the 90s, people in the stock market were saying that, mm-hmm. The internet was new, you know, at the time. They're saying, oh, there's all these internet stocks. They don't make any money. They lose money. But don't worry about that. You got to value them on, I mean, it sounds absurd now, but they're saying you got to value them on their page views and extrapolate that one day these page views are going to be worth, you know, all this fantastic money, which they never were. But the point is, there'll be these ideas in the market. Oh, mm-hmm. You know, there's these new stocks that valuations don't matter, earnings don't matter. And Tesla sort of was one of these kind of situations.
Oh, yeah.
And what's interesting, though, is there's many companies that, you know, kind of were promoted, I would say, this way. And some shifted to become new paradigm situations. So, for example, we've talked about this before, and there's a story about it today, so I'm going to bring it up again. But Facebook made this shift in the past couple months where they were a growth company growing earnings, and you're supposed to buy the stock on the basis of this earnings growth, mm-hmm. not you know, that was happening every single quarter, you know. And the user base is growing, advertising revenue is growing, and that's typically what, you know, that's real. It's on the balance sheet, and that's typically what does drive stocks higher, growing earnings. And it doesn't have to be like a permanent situation. You could have the economy go in a recession, and then earnings, you know, bottom out for some company, and it grows, and the stock goes up. Well, Facebook peaked out in revenue a year ago, the number of users in the United States actually declined. And that set up the stock to do what all stocks do when that happens, that's decline. And it crashed in January. But Facebook tried to, and it's still in the process of trying to claim that those earnings don't matter because it's a new paradigm situation. Just like the person trying to sell me on the pyramid, it's not a pyramid. Well, the Facebook people are basically saying our earnings don't matter because we're now looking at a new paradigm. That new paradigm is called Metaverse. So today, and it hasn't really, you know, the promotion of Metaverse that they've done has so far not helped make the stock go up. It's not working, but it's not making them stop because he has no other card to play. So today, Mark Zuckerberg, he did a virtual roundtable and gave a speech about the Metaverse. And he said he's going to spend billions of dollars on virtual reality headsets. Mm. And what he says is, he said in the speech that the problem with Metaverse, well, he didn't say that. He implied that. He's not really a good speaker. But he said the thing missing, the missing thing. Right. Is or challenges looking at his exact phrases now is that when you wear the current headsets they're not clear, the images aren't clear, it doesn't look like it doesn't look like reality, it looks like a cartoon. So he's going to spend billions of dollars to create virtual reality headsets that he claims will one day look just as good as the real world, though it will not be real.
I got to tell you, Mike, right off the bat.
But here's the thing, though. He says, this image will rival your average 4K TV. Yeah. It's going to be better than your television set now, and this is going to be the thing he claims that's going to make Metaverse actually work.
Okay.
However, why I say this is new paradigm, it's in a pipe dream, is he claims that they won't be able to fully develop this for perhaps a decade because now it's just, you know, much less make it economical for people.
Well, see, but there's the key, okay? The problem is that the technology that he's saying I want to develop already exists. This is what he does. The technology exists. Is it available to consumers and affordable? That's another issue. But they can already do this so that you have very good, seamless virtual reality. It's very expensive, and it's not something you can do with, you know, just your cell phone and something you can pick up at, I don't know where you would pick it up anymore, but maybe at Walmart. It's not something that's available readily on the retail shelves. I'm curious because we're getting like 25 minutes deep in here. We do have a couple of callers on the line, so I didn't know if you wanted to take their calls and get their take on some of this or let them ask a question about it. What do you think?
I'll just make one point.
Absolutely.
The thing about the bear market's having three stages. The first stage is denial. It's people think it's a new paradigm. The second stage, and the market declines, you know, and people just don't believe it. They just think it's a correction. It's no big deal. But the second stage began really early last month when the market made a new low, the S&P fell below 20%. And that's when people start to say, oh, it is a bear market. Mm-hmm. So they're up until, and the media was in denial up until May. In fact, Robinhood sent out an email to its customers saying it's a bear market. Now, what they suggested to do in the email was sell the volatile stocks and technology stocks that are falling so much, which is what all these people own, and buy energy. In other words, sell something and buy something when they should be raising cash. Mm-hmm. And energy stocks, actually, yeah, I own energy stocks, but they've fallen ever since I got that email. Right. So, but that second phase, what people tell themselves, though, is, oh, it is a bear market, I can just ride it out and I'll be okay. Maybe make a few changes, like, oh, I'm going to move, sell some something, buy something. But I'm just going to ride it out. Now, that second stage can last a long time, and the third stage is total pure panic selling. When all the people in the market who may sell and been trying to not do it, do mm-hmm. it. And then you can get the market fall 10% a day, and you know, it's and I don't think we're anywhere close to that third stage even starting. So right. I just want to say you finished the line of thought on that. Three stages to it.
Yeah, no problem. But, you know, regardless of how many stages you want to put on it, there's always, and I know you like to play poker in the casinos, which maybe I'll ask you about that. And who knows, maybe I'll ask you to tell the little anecdote that relates to vultures. maybe. I don't know. We might not get there. But, you know, going to a casino, if you ever hang out with somebody who plays at the slot machines, one thing you always hear is a guy who's losing consistently on the slot machine, and he doesn't want to walk away from it until it pays out. Okay, I know you're not a slot player, you're a poker player, but...
I want to make a comment on that. Mm-hmm. There's a video... I've made a post about the stock market and put this video... You know, it's a video someone made on YouTube.
Yeah.
And this was an addicted gambler in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
The video is like 10 years old. And he's addicted to playing slot machines. And the guy's going bankrupt
right.
and borrowing money to keep playing.
Right.
And it's but he says something in there, which I never really thought about. You know, what's dry, you know, it's just, he says, if you go into a casino,
right,
you'll see somewhere pictures of past winners. Holding million-dollar
yeah.
checks or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You see, like the lottery. You know, someone wins the lottery. You see the lottery winner on television.
Yeah.
And this guy, addicted to the slots, he says at the beginning of the video, "I just wanted to be one of the winners. I just wanted to keep playing till I hit the jackpot
mm-hmm.
and I'll fix my finances." And that's what he just, which is unrealistic. I mean, the odds of
right.
of doing that are so small. It's just like trying to win the lottery. But he talks like he believes all he's got to do is keep playing, and he'll hit it. You know, mm-hmm. and that's just crazy. But that's how that kind of mentality is what. I think that's what all the internet about the stock market and Bitcoin showed people over the past couple of years. People sharing screenshots. They don't do it anymore, but they were sharing screenshots of the gains in their Robinhood accounts, you know, on Twitter, on Facebook, their crypto accounts.
Oh.
And I think that made it so people thought, oh, it's easy to make money. Just like the guy thinking, oh, I can walk in the casino and I just got to keep putting money in the slot. I'll
right.
hit it.
Right.
I think they did that. I think they convinced people that the stock market, all they got to do is buy. All they got to do is get the app.
Late at
all
night.
All they got to do is buy the crypto.
Yeah.
And now they're getting killed. They're getting devastated.
But late at night, that's why I get inundated with these long, like 5-6 minute commercials on YouTube, right? Because I use the free one. I get inundated with, you know what? You can just sit around in my beach house just like I am, and you don't hardly have to do anything, and this and that. Look at the checks I get, and they show you checks, or they show you, you know, envelopes that come in with cash. I mean, to tell you the truth, Mike, I was one of the first guys in the state of New Jersey that started doing this locally where, you know, our big scratch-off winners in a store, we would hang those up, and we would go through a bit of a production putting out things like, look, people have hit $5,000, $10,000, $75,000 in my store. Look, $100,000 winners. And that drove a certain segment of the population to continue, regardless of the fact that, you know, they had spent more than they spend on rent on, you know, the crossword game. I mean, you know, seriously, like it would motivate certain people, like, I got to keep going. I'm going to get that. I'm going to be one of those people. And the casino does it. Everybody does it. Of course, the internet's a wonderland full of this stuff. But with that in mind, let's see what our first caller has to say about it. And you can join in the conversation, you listening live, if you're hearing us live on the 23rd of June on Thursday. Mike Swanson is with us, and we don't usually take calls with Mike. So let's see what we can get out of this. Our first caller is Chris. And, you know, how you doing tonight, man? Welcome to You're on the Air with Mike Swanson and me.
Hello, Mr. Swanson. Hello, Mr. Rocelli. How are you?
All right, Chris.
Oh, doing great.
So awesome. You've been listening to the conversation because you've been hanging on for a while. Sorry about that. But interesting. And of course, this is a common theme. So you have any thoughts on this? Or, you know, you could bring something else up if you like. But any thoughts on the current economic situation, the markets, the gambling, any of it?
Yeah, actually... Actually, it was a three-part question, and it all ties into different aspects of what you guys were just talking about.
Mike, you got a pen? You got a pen? We might have to take notes on a three-part question.
Yeah.
You ready for this one?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, let's go.
Well, it just has three different angles here.
Sure.
First part is the Ukraine situation. Are they still using that as the primary excuse for... You know, with the fuel prices, which then affects everything else, all the, you know, the goods at the supermarket and et cetera. We'll start with there.
Okay. So that's still multiple choice the way I see it in the media as to whether they're going to blame it on that. And, of course, the answer right now is Biden saying that he's going to put a bit of a tax holiday on the gasoline, which, as I've stated several times on this show, the federal tax is not so high. I mean, you're only looking at maybe 20 cents, I think, a gallon. I mean, the total tax burden on a gallon of gasoline in the state of New Jersey is 32.9 cents, and that's the total of state and federal taxes. Now, you go to someplace like California, and it might be up to like 75 cents altogether, but that's because the state taxes are high. But I'm thinking that, you know, maximum... Let's just go with the Jersey model as a maximum, and let's just assume that there are no state taxes in Jersey, which is not true. But let's just say, imagine that you could get, you know, that 32.9 cents off per gallon. Yeah, it's a nice little savings for sure, but is it going to actually change anything? And then, of course, the complaint will come in about we didn't collect the taxes now for a while, so guess what? Something or other will not get done. But I still see Ukraine as being part of the equation. And obviously it's not hurting the Russians because they seem to be making plenty of deals selling it to China. And I guess your door is ajar. That's what I've seen so far, besides your door being ajar, is that they're still introducing it. But it's like multiple choice. Like, They want to give you different answers for why there's the problem. Well, it's still the COVID effect. Well, it's because I've actually heard the argument that unemployment or joblessness is too low. So this is what is causing the problem. Now, I think they're just offering up a buffet and hoping you'll eat something from it as far as the excuses go.
Yeah, because I also heard the January 6th committee had a big part in it.
Yeah, well, I'd love for somebody to explain that to me, but not right this second. Mike... Do you have any thoughts on whether they're still pushing the Ukraine as, you know, in the blame game
the
when it comes
to... primary excuse.
Yeah, when it comes to the...
I'm actually... Mm-hmm. I said two ways. One, yesterday the Federal Reserve isn't saying that. The Federal Reserve chairman, he spoke yesterday, the day before. And he's saying things like, you know, we got to raise interest rates to slow down inflation, but then he'll say there are parts of inflation beyond our control, and then he'll cite Ukraine. So I guess you might say he's having it both ways.
See, he's doing the multiple choice thing I'm talking about, where it's like
all the money and all the money they want. So it
but matter. But it's sort of like, you know,
one thing about the other thing though that's kind of interesting. I'm looking at Biden. I just typed, you know, Joseph Biden inflation on the Google News to see what he said recently. Because I know when the war started, he was certainly blaming, like making it sound like that was the main factor, which I don't believe it is. But it doesn't look like he's been saying much about inflation. I think, you know, he's saying, oh, he wants to do a deal with Saudi Arabia or get more oil on the market. But he's not, I don't see anything on here recently. I'm speaking the past 2 or 3 weeks where he's making big statements. And I bet you the reason why is because every time he talks about it, it probably hurts his poll numbers.
Yeah, it wasn't working.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the
and
way
now
he
he's
went
pleading for more money for the children's COVID vaccines. And meanwhile, I believe we just gave, what, $55 billion to assistance in Ukraine, right?
Yeah, but...
Again, you know, 30, 50, you know, how many times?
Yeah, and also, I mean, look, the administration's position on something is not necessarily going to be the total of what the propaganda push is in the corporate media either. It's always a part of the equation, but not the entire thing, right, Mike? So there's that. So should we move on to part two, or do you have more to add, Mike?
Oh, see what part two is.
All right, part two of the three-part question. Chris, go ahead.
Okay, part two is, should be pretty fast because I don't think it exists, but is there a certain strategy for the, let's just say, the folks in the community that currently have to maybe live in automobiles, is there a beginner's strategy for, you know, some kind of stock market entrance, you know, at the, you know, very base level, like 50 cents here or there, you know?
Okay, so Chris, what you're asking, and I'll turn this over to Mike first and foremost, if you're broke, Is there a way to get involved in the game that'll make sense and maybe help you out if you're broke, Mike? What are your thoughts on that?
There's not really a way to get rich quick in it. That's, you know.
No, not even that. But I mean, just the basic
yeah,
stocks, like
what? Hey, Chuck, do you know the name? Who's the? Do you remember who the libertarian who ran for president in the 80s was?
In the 80s? Wow.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head.
Of Ralph Nader, but that was later.
Yeah.
The reason I bring him up, what's his name? Here, I'll find it.
Go ahead. Go ahead and find that. But I have no idea where you're going here. What I would say about this is, look, I've never had the money. I mean, at one point, I owned Exxon stock, but that's because I got, you know, a discount being that I was employed by them. To make the purchase, right. And actually, I didn't own it personally directly. I owned it on behalf of my children. So, you know, I had them have stock portfolios. But yeah, go ahead.
I found what I'm looking for. Okay, there's something. This guy Harry Brown, he ran as a libertarian for president multiple times.
Oh yeah, okay.
He was an investment advisor, and he wrote a book called. Well, if you type in permanent portfolio, Harry Brown, okay. You'll be able to find what I'm trying to tell you.
Okay.
But basically...
I'll find it, yeah. I'm pretty good with that stuff, yeah.
What it advocates is just being extremely well-diversified. But the big problem people are having now is they got half their money in stocks, for the most part. This is what the average investment advisor tell you. And half the money in bonds, but they're both falling. So Brown's idea was buy stocks, buy bonds, but buy gold too, you know, maybe, you know, diversify in multiple things. And that's his book is the simplest, you know, explanation of that.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah,
I figured it would be a shot in the dark. I mean, it probably didn't exist, but I meant like stuff. You know, if you're cashing in bottles and cans, and you got a couple bucks, like
well, see, everybody's kind of, yeah, right, like, and everybody over the years. I mean, even back in the '80s, there, not just this guy, but I mean, there were people that said, look, you know, invest in utilities and also get if you can get municipal bonds, those are a good thing to have because they're steady and
CDs,
you know, and all this kind of stuff, but. The truth is, if you only got a little bit of money to work with, it's kind of tough. I mean, you can make investments, and frankly, I think it was a good thing when I got in on the stock program with Exxon, because they have programs sometimes where you can focus on something like that. Now, that goes against what Brown was saying, which is to diversify. But the thing is, if you go for something that's, you know, a seemingly indestructible, too big to fail company, and you invest in that, you might not have massive returns, but it will give you some stability and presence in the game. But other than that, I mean, look, I got no advice. I'm not a money guy. So anyway, that was part
you
two.
You might as well just get a scratch ticket.
Yeah. I mean, well, there you go. And if you go to a store like run by an idiot like me, I'm going to hang up when somebody wins $5, $10, $20, $100,000. I'm going to show you that they want it there, you know, to encourage you to dream big, right? A dream, a dollar in a dream,
well,
that's
I'll tell
all it
you,
takes.
I'll tell you, dream big, they said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
So basically, I'll tell you, at a certain point in my life, a few years ago, when I'm, you know, my luck was a little bit better, I was winning like $100 here and there, $50 on like dollar scratch tickets, and I just kept it to that, and I kept, and I only used the winnings to keep rolling it over. I didn't keep putting in new cash in that. That was pretty good for a while, but I think after COVID and all that stuff, the each state probably rigged it somehow, where you're not getting $100 winners.
Well, it's funny because I've heard that over the years. I'll tell you the truth. I've heard that over the years, and I used to have lottery players that, like, I would almost call them professional lottery players that would say the same thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, and I'm not saying this is you, but a lot of them were lying. They would say, oh, no, I only play with them.
I have no reason to. No,
it's okay. Don't.
I didn't check the numbers.
Yeah. No, don't even address it. I'm just telling you what I saw personally. Is
that
people would. They were full
of
crap because I knew they were spending, you know, $2,000 to win the $300. And they would say, oh, no, I only just spend what I make. And this and that, and then they would come back in with reams of these things and go, if you could you double check these through your machine? And it would be like, you know, I'm holding $5,000 worth of, you know, loser scratch-offs. You know, and I'd be sitting there having to go through them for them, like, late at night when I had nothing to do. And
meanwhile, you have a checklist of things to do before you close.
Yeah, of course.
You have these clowns just sitting around.
Well, but I always tried to take care of every customer, even though, you know, and also people have this weird thing about, you make probably thousands and thousands of dollars off of this. It's like, look, the real equation on a lottery agent is $15 per $300 scratch-off book. That's what you get.
Yeah.
You know, and believe me, time, effort, and everything else, it depends. It's not even worth it to run lottery in some places. But it attracts customers, so they tell you bring it in. Anyways, so you got a third part.
We have another caller, so
yeah,
I'll just make my part three really fast.
That's what I was going to get to. Okay, part three.
Okay, part three is a little goofier, but on the same lines as the stock market, because I consider that just basically gambling as well.
Uh-huh.
Does anyone have any tips when it comes to at slot machines or any kind of, you know, little tricks they've heard recently about playing them a certain way, maybe?
This guy, you know, this guy's...
Odds are even.
The only trick I know is try to, if you get up, walk away.
Don't go.
The only winning move is not to play, right? Okay, so... That's what that comes down to. You see, and that's just like the financial newsletter thing you were talking about, where, you know, people are just wanting the tips. How do I get in? What's the good advice, right? So anyway, Chris, I'm going to put you on hold. If you want to hang out for the next hour, you can do that and ask more questions. But I think we're gonna let part three linger there. I don't even want to give advice to somebody about that because. You know, God help us all. If I had that sort of advice, I'd walk into a casino right now and solve all my problems, too. So I don't have it to offer, and I hate to speak for you, Mike, but I don't think you do either at this very moment. Like, what is the quick fix here? What is the advice you can give to somebody to assure them a good run, right?
The best way to make money is to save as much cash as you can and then buy when the bear market's over for the stock market, which is probably not going to happen until next year.
Well, buy low, sell high, and get lucky. What can I say?
Yeah.
Anyways, so we got a couple more callers on the line. We'll try and get to them all and see if we can answer their questions or hear their comments. So I know Bob is calling from California.
Hey, gentlemen, how are you guys tonight?
All right.
I'm listening.
Doing good.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on. I was just wondering, as all this stuff is happening and everything seems to be coming apart, and then you look over, it's hard for the average person to, you know, find too much information about it. But I was kind of wondering about Carl Schwab talking about the Great Reset, going back to the European Management Forum in 1971, talking about a Great Reset. What does this stuff mean? Like, can you give us some insight into that?
What does the Great Reset mean? Is that your general question here?
Well, I mean, as everything's falling apart, it seems like they want to introduce this thing. The things seem like they might want to be linked. They, you know, in some fashion, as our system goes down, are they trying to replace it with these things and an electronic currency and such? I was wondering what you thought about all this and what, you know, the things
Schwab is saying,
it's influencing some real heavy hitters.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase itself came out of, when was it? A meeting, a 2020 meeting. As far, I mean, I think there was a book called that before that, but there was a World Economic Forum conference, and as you said, that Klaus Schwab used that phrase. But honestly, you know, I can't understand what he's talking about, because he just like throws all these things out there, like green energy. I'm looking at an article about it as I'm speaking. This is going to be fourth industrial revolution, and all this. I mean, to me, it's just I don't really know anything specific. It sounds just like someone talking gibberish to me.
Well, these things have been kicked around a lot of times over the years, and not just in the past couple of years, you know, where people have talked about a Great Reset or a new industrial revolution or a paradigm shift, the dollar will collapse.
I mean, I guess two ways to answer it is, what's Schwab talking about? I don't know. You know, he's like throwing a lot of concepts all out there at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's talking about, like I said, green energy, you know, all these different things, and I don't know. They had the power to do any of this stuff, even if they wanted to.
Right.
But, you know, another thing, so the phrase, and then the phrase itself, perhaps it is, maybe, either I just don't know the details, I'm too dumb to understand it, or it's deliberately vague. Either way, I believe certainly what's happened is that the phrase itself has kind of like deep state. It's just taken off to make a life of its own,
well,
disconnected
yeah.
from whatever he was talking about. So I don't really think about it or try to figure it out.
Yeah.
But another thing, though, is there a big shift or change happening? And I think, you know, I think there are. I don't really think anyone can plan it and necessarily control it, though.
Right. And look, you know, the phrase has been used a lot of different times. And Bob, I'm putting you on hold. If you want to hang around for the next hour with Larry Hancock, you can. But the thing is, that phrase has been used a lot of different ways by a lot of different people. And I've had people say to me, no, you just don't understand. It's actually just this. People have picked it up very much like the deep state phrase. And it does mean different things to different people. As far as the, you know, like to me, what it means is that there is this constant program out there to reintroduce new things that keep people largely disconnected from any possibility of wealth, upward mobility within the system. And that is a worldwide sort of thing. And what do? We live in a boom and bust reality. So almost every time there is sort of a reset one way or another when it comes to finances. But there are much larger political and social ramifications here, which are swept up into the Great Reset phrase. You know, some people think it's just a wild conspiracy theory, etc. But I would say it's undeniable that there is a constant manipulation and steering of the overall situation when it comes to finance and all of the above, you know, all the other things that are mentioned. So we also have some other callers here. Mike, I want to get to them as quick as we can because we only have a few more minutes in this hour. And again, each of you that I bring on, you're also welcome to hang around to the next hour, and we'll try and get around to everybody for Larry also. But while we're at it, we have the Let's see. Looks like a outside of the U.S. number, and I don't know who it is, so you're an anonymous caller to me. Your number's, you're on air, though.
Yeah, g'day, Chuck, mate. I'm in that land where I might not even exist on the other side of the world, mate.
Ah, okay, so this sounds to me like Ben from what I would call Oceania, but other people might describe as Down Under or Australia. Am I right?
You're correct, mate. How are you, Chuck? G'day, Mike.
Doing okay, Mike?
Yeah,
Mike,
doing great.
There we go. Okay, so what is your question or comment, Ben?
Question for Mike. That movie, The Big Short, there was a guy in it. His name's Michael Burry. He played the mathematician. He's put out some tweets in the last sort of 96 hours, and now he's pulled down his Twitter, which he often does. But he said that he is, I guess what you could understand from his tweet, that he doesn't know what's going to happen to the market by the end of the year. But his tweet was, just getting one thing right is hard. 1999 tech bubble, he got that right. The 01 to 05 value revival, he got that right. The 2005 housing bubble, he got that right. The 2009 almond farms boom, he got that right. The 2020 COVID bottom, he got that right. The 2020 lockdown horrors, he got that right. 2021 meme stocks, he got that right. 2021 crypto leverage, he got that right. 2021 inflation, he got that right. 2022, we're only halfway there. And he says, late 2022, and he puts up question marks. And then he deleted his Twitter account. Hmm. Mike, you know, they could be dismissed almost as gloating, doing a victory lap of sorts. But he also notes that he has no idea what the next 6 months will bring. And I guess that's pretty extraordinary that he can't even define what's coming. If we take into account his track record, what's happening over there with the market, mate?
Well, I mean, if you look at the, I didn't know he said these things recently, so you're telling me news I didn't know about, but he's been bearish on the stock market at least a year, saying it was going to decline, it's a big bubble, and I agree with him. I think it's a bear market, and I define one, the way I try to identify one is you can go to website, stockcharts.com, type in a symbol, and you can see, the 200-day moving average is the green line on this website. And when the market is above that, it tends to act as a support level. So when the price falls to it, it'll go back up. But when you're in a bear market, it'll trade below that. It's been doing that all year, just about. So I think we're in a real bear market. And what he was, you know, I mean, when the Fed took rates to zero in 2020, that helped to stimulate the stock market. When they're now raising interest rates, it's having the opposite effect. So I think it's all part of a bigger cycle, but it's tough. You know, when I'm saying those things, though, I'm kind of thinking out, you know, this is probably going to last for the rest of the year, at least into November, December, probably into next year. But I really don't know what it's going to do next week or next month. And
sounds to me like you're agreeing with his question marks tweet, if that's what he tweeted out about the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think that's what he's probably suggesting too, from what it sounds like. Mm.
So there you have it,
so
Ben.
I guess the question then is if he doesn't literally have any idea of what's going on. This is uncharted territory we're in, and his mathematical prediction models are unable to even guess at what will happen. There has been reports I just came across this morning that said perhaps in America you guys might reinstitute, or some states might reinstitute, zero deposit home loans again to get home buyers into the market. Now, wasn't that the whole reason that the housing bubble pretty much happened?
Yeah, it helped contribute to it. Well, one thing about the Burry fellow, though, I don't know how he makes his, you know, forecasts or predictions. Like, I don't know if he's using a mathematical formula or really, I have no idea what he's looking at. And in the Big Short movie, all he was doing was looking at the balance sheets of different mortgage securities and companies, and realizing that, hey, these things are actually bankrupt. You know, he wasn't running any. He was doing stuff that you know, like old fashioned. You know, having literally the books of and reports in front of him, and not running computer programs. You know, he's doing something people might have done 50 years ago, and now almost no one does.
Which is
kind of interesting.
And really quickly, I think it's important to note that the idea that it was just the no doc, zero down mortgages that made that bubble happen, that's a fallacy. That is not entirely what did it. It contributed to it, as Mike said, but that's not the whole of what went wrong there. I mean, when you got evaluations that were so hugely inflated, you know, that was the other problem, is that when all of a sudden you would have appraisals that would screw up the entire equation, and you buy something that's based on this completely inflated equation, and then to try and resell it, you can't. That was another problem too. It was this really like a sort of a industry-wide greed model that pumped and inflated all that stuff, and then on top of it, you had people that shouldn't have been getting mortgages that got them. But it was secondary to the fact that it was this overly inflated, imaginary, crazy market that was, to my mind, driven a lot by greed. More than anything. And, of course, the banks and the lending institutions that were not banks made it worse. And it just exponentially increased. It's not, you know, it's not a snowball made of one thing, is all I'm saying. It's not just because, oh, people that shouldn't have gotten those mortgages, it's their fault. No, they didn't help. But there was a whole other thing going on there where people were inflating the value of things at such a completely unrealistic rate that that it was inevitable that was going to bust. I mean, it's just, you know, there's just more to it than that. That's all I'm saying about it. I mean, I can't even fully articulate it myself, but I can tell you that there was more to that story than anybody wanted to tell, as they repeated it over and over again about exactly how that crash occurred. And it wasn't just these poor idiots who couldn't do math and didn't realize they couldn't afford their houses. That was part of it, but definitely wasn't even... If that was all by itself in the equation, probably would not have had the disaster we had with the housing crash. But anyway, that might just be my opinion.
That,
anyway, we do have
I appreciate that.
Right. And look, if you want to, I mean, you're calling internationally, so I wouldn't hang on the line, but you're welcome to call back in, Ben. In the next hour, we're going to change topics for sure with Larry. So I'm going to put you on hold for now. And thanks for calling in. Thanks, everybody, for calling in. We do have one more caller, though, Mike, that I wouldn't mind trying to squeeze in, if you don't mind, to see what they have to say about this. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I only got a couple. I got to go pretty quickly, though.
Yeah, we're going to get going right away, but... I couldn't let the whole call-in hour go by here without letting the legend himself at least put in 2 cents, and that would be Jimmy James, who calls into every show. Love this guy. He has his own fan club, Mike. I don't know if you know that. But Jimmy James, question or comment? Kind of got to go quick, though. Jimmy. Whoops, hold on. There we go. Now we have Jimmy James. My mistake there. Sorry. Jimmy James, got to go quick on it, but your question or comment, sir?
Comment quickly for Seagraves. Casino tip, if you're going to the Indian casinos, get there around 5 or 6 when they do the turnkeys and switch them all around.
Ah.
I notice this is beneficial for you.
All right.
The one-armed bandits.
So you got a beneficial strategy for the Indian casinos, basically.
Well, let's just say I was crying. I lost $600-700. All of a sudden, they were doing their 4 or 5 in the morning turnkey things and refill ups and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way out, I accidentally put in my last 20, and I didn't. I had thought I was. I put maximum bet. I didn't even realize I bet the whole thing. Bam. Got like $1,600.
Nice. So you walked out a winner because you waited for the shift change.
Well, unbeknownst to me, that's just what I learned.
You stumbled into it. You stumbled into it and that worked.
Yeah.
Okay. Mike, what were you going to say to that?
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. Hey, if it worked, it worked.
Hey, listen, and as long as it does work, great. And I've heard a couple other strategies like that where they tell you to wait for a certain time of day because that's when they reset this, that, the third thing. And quite honestly, you know, like I see people running over to tables, even blackjack tables, you know, as soon as they change a dealer, new shoe comes in, boom, get on it. Right? Okay, so for the Indian casinos, if you're there at like 4 or 5 in the morning, when they're doing their turnkey shift thing, then you can get in on the machines and they'll be a little more loose. At least they work for you, Jimmy James, huh?
It worked out for me.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, Jimmy James, I'm going to put you on hold and I'm going to close out this hour with Michael Swanson, of course, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State, Why the Vietnam War. Go over to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street, even though we did talk about Wall Street a bit tonight. There are a variety of topics, and I'm telling you, Mike, I might want you to tell that vulture story one day on air, but only if you're comfortable with it. totally unrelated story, because I was talking to Mike, a couple of days ago, and I'll tell you, I was cracking up. I really was. Funny story, but anyways... Not tonight. Mike Swanson, how would you like to close out the hour, sir?
Oh, well, we had a good talk here, and we'll follow up again next week. Thanks for having me and for all the people that called in.
Absolutely. Listen, it's always our pleasure to have the great Michael Swanson with us. In the next hour, Larry Hancock, also great author, author of a few more books than Mike, actually. But Mike's written a lot of books. Check him out. I'll give you his stuff in the show links. Go over to WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. And stick around and listen to the Ocelli Effect for the next hour because you're going to get to know some other stuff with Larry Hancock. As I said, Mike, thanks for doing this with me, man. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Good talk with you.
Revelation through conversation.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State. State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Ochilli.com. News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ochilli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ochilli Effect continues now at Ochilli.com. But, of course, you could be some other time, some other place, taking a listen to this. And we do replay it on our network as well as some others throughout the weeks that follow the live broadcast. But if you're listening to us on June 23rd, just after 9 p.m. Eastern, actually almost quarter after 9 p.m. Eastern, I started late here tonight, so sorry. But if you're hearing us June 23rd, just after 9 p.m. Eastern time, you could call into the show, 319-527-5016, 319-527-5016. And this ought to be a good little discussion why we got Larry Hancock with us, the author of a great many books. I'm not going to take up a good portion of the hour listing them all, but he's written a few times about the JFK assassination, not just in his own book, but online, been a presenter at conferences, is just one of the best people to talk about regarding this topic. Of course, he's written about a great many other things, the behavior of the national security state, ranging, you know, everywhere from covert operations. You hear the commercial for In Denial, but also covert operations all the way to the reaction of the national security state regarding UFOs in the book Unidentified, creating chaos. I mean, please, the man's got a list of stuff that he's written about, spoken about, and educates all of us about if you avail yourself of said education. Anyways, Larry. And Larry-Hancock.com, that's where you can go, or you can just go get his books, read them. There is not a bad one in the bunch, and he takes up more spaces in my bookshelf than any other individual author. So, Larry, how you doing, man? We do have phone calls already, and like I said before, others could join at 319-527-5016. Feel free to do so. Let's try and stay on topic, and the rule still applies. You are allowed to abuse the host, but not the guest or co-host in this case, which would be Larry Hancock. So there you go. Larry, first off, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, and I've got to say that's one of those rules I really like, Chuck. I appreciate that. But no, I'm good this evening. It's always good to be here and chat. With your introduction, I would like to say one thing.
Sure.
After having been in the JFK genre venue for over 30 years, the one thing that I can claim is that over those 30 years, I learned some things. In fact, I learned one of the things that I should have known in the beginning is that know your subject very thoroughly before you start reaching conclusions.
Yeah, a lesson that I wish a lot of other people would have learned. You know, we're not going to go there tonight. Man, we did do a show not too long ago about how not to formulate a JFK conspiracy theory, and I urge people to go look back at that or any of the other shows in the archives with Larry Hancock, of which there are a fairly voluminous amount of hours that Larry has put up with me on this show. So, anyway, yes, indeed, I wish that a great many other people would heed said lesson. You know, internalize it to some degree and maybe practice some of what has been preached at them. Please, you know, before you go out there with your grand theory, bring some evidence and some facts. That's helpful. Just saying. Okay. Anyway, Larry, enough of that. I know we're going to talk about Lee Harvey Oswald tonight. And it's unfortunate that we have to talk about Lee Harvey Oswald. We're getting close to 60th anniversary time here of the events in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963. I mean, it's only a year and a half away, Larry.
That does seem sort of amazing, doesn't it, Chuck?
Hmm.
But I think one of the reasons why we still have to talk about some of these subjects is that we've learned things along the way. It's it's way too easy in this area of research, as in others, to just keep repeating the same things. Like, I could repeat something that I saw in CompuServe, you know, in 1995, and repeat it as fact because everybody else was saying it. It's just kind of like, oh, well, we know this. We know this for certain. But in the next three decades, we've learned a lot. And I don't think in a lot of cases, I just saw someone going, well, you know, recommend the best book on a particular subject. And everybody was coming back with books that were written in the 90s. Well, there's some great books written in the 90s, but having written books in the 90s myself, it's like, no, wait a minute. Don't just read those books, even if they were great, because you're leaving out so much that we've learned through the JFK records releases or the Assassinations Records Review Board or FOIAs. So don't just read those books in the 90s and repeat what authors were saying, including myself, as if it were stone cold fact and nothing had been learned since.
Well, even evidentiary media has surfaced since the 90s. A lot of things that people thought were not memorialized or recorded because nobody had a VCR back in 1963, or virtually nobody had one. They were in existence, but most Americans didn't have one and weren't recording, you know, broadcasts. So there are a lot of people that thought that archival footage, a lot of stuff that was preserved for television, doesn't exist, and it does. You know, there were other, even films from Dealey Plaza have emerged since the 1990s that did not make it into circulation previously. Photographs, witness statements, right? A couple of things have been picked up and stuff like this that was not necessarily available to the public at that time, and therefore not available to the average author at that time. I mean, there's just a more well-rounded pool of resources one could draw upon to put their mosaic together. I mean, it's just, what can I say? I mean, there's just more that's available now. And, you know, again...
Well, I think a good example, since we're talking about Lee Oswald, is a lot of source material was collected by, you know, initial investigations. One of the things that we've learned is that the Warren Commission collected a large body of information on Lee Oswald in the Marine Corps.
Right.
Interviews with dozens and dozens of people who knew them. And that never made it into the Warren Commission report or into the volumes. Mm-hmm. And when people learned about that after the fact, like a couple of decades later, three decades later, and started searching for those, like many materials that were actually accumulated, since they were not used in the report or the volumes, were handed off to various other places, like universities. Okay, so researchers start looking for them, and they find out, oh, well, okay, there's a university, and I have to get somebody's permission who donated them. They contact the people who donated them, and the people go, okay, sure, I'll give you permission. Go look at it. A researcher goes and looks for all those Marine review interviews on Oswald, and they're all missing, and nobody knows why they're missing. Okay. But I have a friend, and I messaged you this, who on his own, he was a Marine Corps officer. He actually was stationed at Itsugi. He was in intelligence and counterintelligence. He took it on his own to interview a ton of those same people and to go back and collect records on Oswald that you won't find anywhere in the Warren Commission volumes, and really give us some new sights into Oswald in the Marine Corps, Oswald as an individual, that are unique. And this is the kind of stuff that's emerged over the last few years, that if you kind of stay stuck, you know, in the books of the 90s, you're just not going to see.
Well, right. But in fairness, again, to the people that wrote those books in the 90s, right, I would say that when you had a mysterious patch of things here where you had just fragmentary information regarding his behavior in the Marine Corps and this and that, It was not hard for somebody to maybe speculate with missing pieces of the information, so to speak, to speculate that, look, the guy was clearly rubbing up against all these different people that were involved in spycraft. Perhaps he had been a spy of some sort that is a bit more romanticized by some authors, let's say. you know, and then when you actually end up with the records and you find out and you're able to put together timelines and things like this, well, maybe some of the mystery goes out of the story, because now you know that, you know, he was stationed here or there or had access to this or that, whereas before people were speculating about it, right? I mean, this would be a fair thing to say, and this is why there must be an evolution in this information regarding Oswald, who has been painted as all sorts of different characters, one way or another. You know, the crazy kid who, you know, and again, remember, he was only 24 when he died, right? I mean, not you, Larry. I know you know that. But I'm saying, you know, keep in your mind, you're talking about a 24-year-old guy who did not have a long life, but definitely had some adventures there. And when you start to put together the pieces a bit, and you're you got all sorts of gaps in the information, kind of easy to fill them in with a little speculation. But again, when you're able to fill some of those gaps a little better, it starts to maybe paint a different picture. Or am I just going off in the wrong direction here, Larry?
No, and I think when, and I'm a subject to this as everybody else, you know, we hate to give up mysteries. Let's face it. Anybody that's going to research a subject that where conspiracy is an element, you know, and where you need to work at overturning an official story that is clearly wrong, okay, you tend to delve into the mysteries. I think nobody can be blamed but for that. I mean, the whole goal of the writers from the very beginning, the first generation, was to identify mysteries and to identify things that needed to be addressed. I think the problem is that identifying mysteries is good, but you have to be willing to give them up when they become not mysteries. If you can't ever give up a mystery, if you can't ever give up a suspicion, if you can't ever, you know, if you can't ever enter reality and you kind of are forced to cling to this, well, I like this conspiracy, I want to stay here, then there's a problem in itself, right? You know, and I say that as a conspiracy researcher and writer. So, you know, obviously, you know, I have things that I've written that if I were republishing a book, I would take out. As a matter of fact, I think when I rewrote, did a second and third editions of Someone Would Have Talked, for each edition, I actually ended up taking things out that had been resolved and were no longer mysteries, or that simply couldn't be defended. Mm. So it's kind of a call to, when we're talking about something like Lee Oswald, it's just a call for a broader view and not to become fixated with the Oswald that we want. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a real tendency to look and find what you want that supports your view. Right. And I'm all for, yeah, you need to look, but don't look just to support your view. Look at everything that's there.
Right. So, look, with that in mind, Larry, I want to introduce one of the callers in and also tell people that they can join in, 319-527-5016. I know it got very busy with Mike there, but don't wait till the end of the hour, because you do that, I got to try to fit you in fast, and that's a little unfair to everybody. So try and get in as early as possible, 319-527-5016. Once again, if you're hearing us live on June 23rd, just after 9:25 p.m. now on the eastern part of the country here in the U.S., yeah, it's time to get in and call and ask a question, add a comment, and we are going to talk about the you know, the situation regarding Lee Harvey Oswald and exactly how he's painted. And I've held Larry back a bit so far because I wanted to see what you guys might want to add in. And perhaps that will change the direction of the discussion a little. Okay, I know it's living dangerously, Larry, and we don't usually take calls, but you ready to take a couple of calls?
Oh, no problem.
All right, let's do that. So first off, we have Chris, who held on from last hour and definitely added some interesting thoughts to the discussion with Mike Swanson. But you're on with Larry Hancock, and we are talking about the ever-changing face of Oswald and how one has had to re-examine these things in the research community over time, really not getting to the full meat of what Larry wanted to talk about just yet. But Chris, you got a question or a comment regarding this subject?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, it's an honor, Mr. Hancock. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing? Okay, I actually do a little bit of research here and there on JFK, on various subjects, especially his son, JFK Jr., and his death. But my question for you is, recently I've come across some material that I think connects the University of Texas tower sniper, Charles Whitman, with Lee Harvey Oswald and the Marines. And also I found out that they both had jobs at one point at NASA facilities, maybe in Houston, Texas, at one point. Have you ever heard such connections?
As far as Oswald is concerned, I have not heard that. What we do know for sure is that when Oswald was in New Orleans, and he thought, because a lot of the workers at the place he was working at the time were going to work for NASA in the new engine test facilities outside New Orleans, he really thought that he might be able to get a job there. So there's at least a connection between Oswald having expressed an interest in and a hope of going to work with NASA, but that would have been in the New Orleans area, not in Houston. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be, I'd have to get the age differential, but there would seem to be a fairly radical difference in age between the Texas tower shooter, as I recollect the age at which he was supposed to have done his attack, versus when he would have been with the service but I've never heard Oswald and NASA a little bit of a possible connection, but not the Texas tower shooter.
Yeah, I know that when he was working at Riley.
I know that John Connolly actually. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, well, I'm just saying, I know when he was working at Riley that there was a bunch of people that had actually gotten jobs with some companies that were working with the space agency. Right. Worked for Riley. I know that happened, but my understanding about his job at Riley was that it was like a temp job anyway. And I don't know that he was one of those people that was like in that group, say, of individuals that were trying to get that job. But it is like a proximity sort of thing where it does seem like, some people that were looking to be employed with a couple of NASA related facilities. One of them being that engine testing thing that Larry was talking about. But I know about that, but I don't know about Oswald actually doing anything with that. You know, I don't know that he ever applied or what when it came to his time in New Orleans. And the whole thing with Houston would actually be new to me as well. But anyway, that's as far as I can take
I
that.
I have to go back and check the thing that I was that I, the piece the news article that I had found from the 60s. But I offhand doesn't really help us right now. But I know that John Connolly actually had a commission open to explain Charles Whitman's why he did what he did, and they had some kind of bogus explanation with a brain tumor kind of thing. I always thought the John Connolly thing was pretty curious too. But just one other thing I wanted to ask Mr. Hancock, if I could, have you ever come across anything related to possible other plots at the Trade Mart and at Love Field going back? other shooter and spotter teams and possible other patsies? Because I've come across some things on that too, but I'm not exactly sure if it's bogus or not.
I have, and one of them is particularly interesting because, as far as I know, it was never explained. And it comes from the Dallas police tape, and there is a transmission on the Dallas police tape that apparently originates at Love Field. The caller is at Love Field, and to kind of quote exactly, the call is something on the order of, we have taken custody of a number of armed men at Love Field. And that's it. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, if that doesn't make you stop and pause, but then there's no report of that. There are reports of a lot of other people taking into custody, you know, at different places, but there's never a print report to follow up on that. So there's one of the things I will
the
say
only
that
place I found was where Penn Jones had actually mentioned it in his first book, I believe, and he cited some sources on that. But he also said that it was also a scenario that was pretty closely resembling the Ambassador Hotel kitchen area kind of scenario had JFK been able to actually make the trademark. And I always found that interesting that no one else really talks about. So I appreciate your insight.
I will say this about that, and that is that probably the most intense security in Dallas was at the trademark. In the trademark. And one of the reasons for that was that that's where they expected a violent protest to occur. The Dallas police officer in charge of security for the whole visit was at the trademark. They actually had taken the trouble to prepare a mug book of all the right-wing folks in Dallas who had protested against the UN ambassador and who had against Johnson.
Adelaide Stevenson.
They were all over the trademark. There are memos saying that they were screening the food servers. They were, so I would just, all I would say is that is that, and they did actually arrest a number of people at the trademark. We often don't think about that, but they did arrest people at the trademark who were already in custody by the time of the attack. Now, most of those were, quite frankly, people that were, you know, had banners that were had, you know, saying not what you'd want on the TV coverage of him appearing, but
they wanted for treason, all the posters and everything.
This was at the direction of Jesse Curry. This was at the direction of Jesse Curry, who was very intensely trying to suppress any sort of like scene or incident that might get started where a protest or a problem would come out, and they would be seen as the DPD as not handling things properly because they were worried about that making the news. That, you know, the DPD, and in fact, Curry went on TV the day before and made a whole statement about, you know, listen, we're not going to tolerate any nonsense while the president's here. I forget the exact wording, but interesting thing about the people taken into custody at Love Field is that I went through Decker's stuff and I went through the DPD stuff, and unlike the people that were detained at the trademark, I could not find paperwork on people being detained at Love Field in Decker's files or the DPD files.
So it's kind of like the Dealey Plaza suspects, too.
That's always been very suspicious to me. Now, were they actually federal agents that we don't know about? Were they, you know, I'm with you. To me, that's one mystery that remains, and I don't know how we would resolve it. I don't think somebody made a mistake with that broadcast.
Yeah.
I think that was real. Who they took into custody is a real interesting question.
Well, kind of like the dead Secret Service agent reports initially, too.
Well, the dead Secret Service agent, though, I think was simply a mistake of the media in the fog of the situation. which I've always said, because there was the, you know, they were talking about that before, even, because some people said, oh, no, it's just confusion with Tippett. And I'm like, no, before Tippett was even reported, the media was out there with this idea that there might have been a wounded Secret Service agent.
Yeah.
And I don't know where that really came from, because, as we well know, there was no Secret Service agent who was wounded in any significant way. I mean, I don't know about scraped knees or anything. But nobody was shot.
They did have pools of red liquid everywhere, too, that people thought may have been blood.
Yeah.
That was also a part of the confusion, I think.
Yeah, well, it was like Jerry Coley or whatever his name was. The one newspaper reporter had talked about that. And he's not the only...
He licked his finger.
Yeah, well, and there was another eyewitness to it, also worked in the local media. But here we go with local media people who reported things at the time, and I think the pool of blood thing was actually pulled from his written report to the newspaper initially. And then at some point it came out. But there was a bit of confusion there, and the idea that a Secret Service agent was shot, it just seemed to me to be one of those mistakes that was made.
Could have been, yeah.
You know, but then again, the media...
Chaos at the time, yeah.
It would not have been hard to think, if I was observing what was happening, you know, with people moving around inside the limos.
Right.
You know, certainly there were agents moving around inside the MOs, around, you know, okay, you can almost imagine. Look at the picture of the limo as it's pulling out onto the freeway. Unfortunately, what you see is JFK's leg sticking up in the air. You know, somebody might have taken that for a Secret Service. Just don't know. That's why I come back
to the... I never thought of that. Yeah.
That's why I kind of come back to the... I don't think the tape was mistaken. You don't take armed people into custody. You know, it's true, it's Dallas. I mean, frankly, you know, who knows who could have been. But the way it was stated, it's like a group of armed. You know, like, that's... It's a little different.
That's a little different, yeah. And it's
so
also,
they actually were armed, though, in the reports. They actually did have... That's what the broadcast, you know,
well, that's, they, yeah, that's in the one piece of audio, but that's the thing, is that we got no paperwork to follow it up. You know, the other thing that I thought was memorable from that day is the newspaper reporter that quotes Oswald as saying, I got me a cop, I got me a president, and I'm going to get two more, or whatever it was he said. And he said it like it was a... like 1930s gangster character almost, you know.
yeah, that's right.
And that was like
that J.D. Tippett died at the movie theater trying to apprehend Oswald too. I remember that cover story was put out pretty early too.
Yeah, but see, again, whether it's that's intentional or that's just a mistake of convoluting things together, you know, it's all questionable.
We'll never know.
But the broadcast you know, that Larry's talking about, you're talking about a police communication. So, you know, that's a little different. And again, there would
pretty
be
official.
No. Yeah. Well, unofficial, but official enough in that something is being said here. There, you know, there's no reason to communicate that as like a cover story. You know, today somebody might put out a false broadcast because people know that everybody's listening on the scanners. You know what I'm saying? But at that time, there's almost no purpose for doing it. Except that there was some kind of situation that happened there. And again, it's not just one guy. So that is one of those things, though, that, again, why is there no paperwork about it? Why is there no incident report? You know, where is it? And if the sheriff doesn't have it, the police...
Just like all the suspects in Dealey Plaza, like with the tramps and everything, there's no paperwork. They were released quietly and never seen or heard from.
But there was paperwork on the tramps.
A dramatic example of that is the fact that we know that a police officer directed the crime scene squad to recover a bullet from south side of Elm Street. I mean, we have the police officer's report saying he did that.
Right.
And then we have...
Oh, there's a photo too, of an FBI agent putting it in his pocket. Is that the same one you're referring to?
Well, it goes along with it, but we actually have a photo of a shot back towards the TSPD with a crime scene kit in it.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the crime scene people were there, but there is absolutely no report saying, oh, we responded to the officer's direction and we didn't find anything. You know, it's like you've got, there are three pieces that you should have and you've got two of them for sure. And it's like, we know you were there. Why didn't you just fill out a report that said we didn't find anything?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good...
Right.
Well, there you go. So, look, I'm going to put you on hold, Chris, get to another caller, but these are interesting points and questions, Larry. We got one more on the line, and then we'll proceed afterwards, if you don't mind. Okay, I go to this next caller, Larry?
Yeah, you bet.
All right. So I do know that I was expecting this gentleman to call back in. Jimmy James, you got a question or comment for Larry Hancock?
I have 10,000 questions for Professor Hancock.
Okay. I did not know you were a professor, Larry, but...
and I can come up with at least three answers.
Excellent. Three answers for 10,000 questions. That's better than a lot of other people. Okay. Go ahead, Jimmy James. Sorry.
Okay. For Larry Crayford, first off, is this guy dead? Do we know he's dead? Where is he? What happened to him?
We do not. I've not seen an obituary. We know they lost him, as far as I know. They literally lost him. They tried to recover him. Chuck, as I recall, they did locate him at the assassination, interviewed him briefly, and that was it, as far as I know. I don't know that anybody has recovered him since then. I don't know that he's been re-interviewed, which means I don't know if he's alive or dead. Do you know any better than that?
Well, go ahead, Jimmy.
I don't know, but it's about his, whether he's alive or not, but I very much want to know. But one thing I was reading the other day in his go-between with Griffith is that he mentions that he had a brother-in-law in Dallas, which means he had a sister in Dallas. And this also, he mentions that he worked for Porter Building. So this whole story about him happened to show up in Dallas and being at a carnival and running into Jack Ruby, I don't know what all that crap's about. He had family roots in Dallas, it seems to me, right?
Yeah, what I can tell you is I don't know if you're a member of the education forum, but there is a researcher who over the last few months has devoted a tremendous amount of time to just that question that you're talking about. The fact that it wasn't a simple story of just showing up in Dallas, that he did have family connections there, that, you know, and he's done some really good work on this. You know, I could give a link to it, but I do know that this fellow has commented that he has tried to locate him, to interview him, and has been unsuccessful.
Right. Jimmy, I muted you.
His research has been really good.
So, Jimmy, I muted you only because we were getting a little feedback from your phone. I'm going to bring you back on in a second. But, yeah, Larry, if you want to give me that link, I'll include it with the show notes so people could go and read it. Even if you're not a member of the education forum, you can go read a thread because they won't let me in there, by the way.
Let me do that. That would, Jared, that really will give you a lot more detail. It's the most detail I've seen turned up on Crawford in years.
Right.
So I think that might be very helpful for you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I'm going to unmute you, Jimmy. Sorry about that, but we were getting a lot of feedback. So go ahead, though, if you had something else you wanted to add.
I lowered the volume. Does it sound any better now?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not hearing us feedback as much. So, yeah, thank you. But did you have something else you wanted to add?
Oh, yes. Lots of questions. The last episode of Quick Hits with Doug Campbell and Rob Clark, they read a letter from the 90s between two researchers. For the first time, I heard a real name attached to the Babushka lady. And they just mentioned that the lady's name was Lena Beck. So then I went to, of course, and did a search over to Mary Farrell's. I did a search, and of course it popped up. She was in the FBI master file, whatever report, the Gimberling report. And yeah, they really went to great efforts to find a woman named Beck, because she had contacted the Detroit Free Press and said that she had a motion picture of the assassination, and she gave her name as Beck. And they were looking all over in Lincoln Park, which is near Detroit, for this woman. The FBI was. So they clearly took it seriously. Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm sorry. I don't, and nor did I listen to Doug's show on that one. I've been on Doug's show a couple of times recently, but with totally different type of research. Sorry to strike out on your question, but no, that's, I mean, I'm aware of the fact the FBI had those kind of reports and did research. I mean, they basically took any report of anybody that claimed to have film and looked into it. Seriously. Yeah, you can tell that they were really interested in wrapping up that film, but I nothing more than what you said. Sorry.
Well, and Richard Sprague, not the guy who started out running the HSCA and then was replaced, but the other Richard Sprague, right? At one point, I tracked down who I think he was correct, a woman who had a camera and seemed to have been the Babushka lady. Problem was that her film did not turn out. You ever read up on that, that Sprague had tracked that down, like, in the 70s? Larry?
I do recall that, but the problem for me is, again, as with Sprague and some of that, the documentation. Yes, you can find that he was interested in that person, but I don't know of anybody that's ever found any more detail, you know, enough to carry it further. I hate to say anything bad about Sprague, but it seems that the documentation from that investigation, the internal documents, really aren't nearly what we either they didn't write nearly enough memos,
or... Well, right, but as he did say, that Lady Beck was in the Gimmerling report, even as somebody who was, you know, potentially a witness or whatever, but apparently wasn't quite as useful as some other witnesses. I mean, that's just the way that came out. But yeah, no, there's a couple of things here, and also, as I've stated many times, there's many more than one woman wearing a babushka in Dealey Plaza. I count four. I don't know how many times you've been through the photo arrays, but I count four. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there's more. But I'm certain that there are four different women with that kind of headdress on in Dealey Plaza during these events, during that very short time period. Have you ever done that and taken a look to see through the photo arrays how many different characters you can track through their movements and stuff? Yeah. As people were shooting photos,
I think we came up with a count of four or five. And I would say I've talked with Beverly. You know, I've talked with Beverly. I've talked with Beverly about Dealey Plaza and about Jack and all this stuff. And there's no surprise that there would be people. That was a standard head cover on a day that was windy and, you know, misty. So it also doesn't suggest anything very suspicious. As far as Beverly's answer to that would be, oh, I was out all night. I didn't have a chance to fix my hair. You know, Chuck, we kind of get lost in these things. It's sort of like, I just, after a certain point, it's like, there's no information I can draw from this.
No, I understand. I'm just since it came up, I just figured, you know, I'd mention it because he's hitting on this one very interesting lady who, again, you know, did an interview with the, the Detroit Free Press or something. And, you know, I'm just saying that there's a lot of stuff like this, though, that, again, has been, you know, partially developed by citizen researchers in a lot of cases. And they don't necessarily have all the information or have tracked it all down. But it doesn't mean, you know, that they didn't put some efforts in. And these are the kind of things that, again, if you go through them over time, other people have discovered other things. You know, it's a hell of a thing to assemble, is all I'm saying. So, anyways, yeah. So,
and I'm sorry, I think I struck out on all three questions, but what can I say?
Well, let's give Jimmy one more shot. He said he had 10,000, but how about one more, Larry, and then we'll move on.
how about a softball, a slow ball on this one?
Ah, you got a softball question, Jimmy? I mean, we're doing our best here.
Well, I got one that I know the professor knows. I got all kinds of information on this guy. He's a living witness, and I think it's awful important that we get this guy under oath testifying, Rabbi Beckham.
Oh, yes. Well, Joan Mellon says that she has him under oath. I mean, yes, I do know Mr. Beckham quite well. Not personally quite well, but I know his history quite well. In all honesty, and I did this, I think, probably 3 or 4 years ago. I put together a CD with every single document that I could find on Beckham and Chrisman, their whole story. And my conclusion is this. I think Beckham has already told us all of the truth he has to tell, which counted for about, 3% of every word he's ever spoken. And the truth that he had to tell us that is interesting and important is that he was indeed present at Lee Harvey Oswald's leafleting. And he actually did speak with Oswald in New Orleans. And so later, when he gave testimony that said, oh, yes, I have been in contact with Lee Oswald. I saw him. I was there when he was passing out leaflets. I absolutely take that part of his story as gospel. And the reason I take it as gospel is we have an expanded photograph, and I've tried to communicate this for many years, which shows Mr. Beckham not only there's photos showing him in a close-up where Oswald is leafleting, but if you go over to the right in that photo, you see these three young Latina girls sitting there chatting. And one of those Latina girls, I am practically certain, is Mr. Beckham's underage wife, who he had just married, and her girlfriends. They're all dressed up very prettily, and that he is telling the truth. And that is the marriage that he actually got prosecuted for because she was underage. But in my view, that's the only thing I would trust Thomas Beckham having said, because he and Mr. Chrisman were scam artist extraordinaire. So, see, at least I took a position on that one.
There you go. You did take a position. So, you happy with those answers, Jimmy?
Well, I think the Beckham has more information that needs to be gleaned.
Have you read Joan's interviews with him? I mean, she did spend a ton of time, and he went on record with her as recently as, what, about 6-7 years ago? Mm. I mean, I don't know what more that he could say, especially since he was already in. You got to remember, Beckham is a guy who actually confessed to being directly involved in the assassination. I mean, what? And he named who involved him. And he named how it came about, and he named how he was sent to Dallas, and what he did in Dallas, and how, I mean, you know, other than, and he revealed that all early on to Garrison. And Garrison decided that it was bogus and he couldn't do anything with him. But, I mean, Beckham's testimony is extensive as early as the Garrison investigation.
Well, fair enough.
Yes. Yeah. But like when Delsa interviewed him, he would say, Beckham would say things like, Yeah, there was 60 of us, and we were all in this certain organization. And then Dowsa says, okay, let's take a lunch break, and never ask them, well, what is this organization? Is it the Chamber of Commerce? Doubt it.
Hmm. Well, there you go. So, Jimmy James, I thank you for the call, and look, there's a lot more to be explored, and again, take a look at the interviews with Beckham and some of these other characters. There's still some undeveloped information. There's always more to be developed, isn't there? So, anyways, I'm going to put you back on hold.
With yeah. Beckham, anyone that's interested in Beckham and needs to also study Beckham and Chrisman, because mm-hmm. the full story isn't just Beckham. It's Beckham and Chrisman essentially implicating themselves in the conspiracy to Garrison. It's a very complex story, and when you talk about the people that you're working for, you've got to get the full story of what both Beckham and Chrisman said to be able to judge. I guess that would be my point. It's not just Beckham, it's Beckham and Chrisman.
Mm. Fair enough. So, Larry, we actually ate up a bunch of time with the questions. So
who is Lee Harvey Oswald?
So who is Lee Harvey Oswald? Well, you know, look, we can always go back to that at another time. I was really wanting to get into it with you. We've got some time left, but maybe you have some other thoughts on some of the things that have been brought up here. Or the original premise that, you know, I kind of slow rolled there and I shouldn't have. I should have gotten right to it, I guess. But I didn't expect the questions to go as long as they did. But I do appreciate you guys for calling in and doing that. Anyways, Larry, what else should we add to what has been discussed tonight?
Well, I think one of the things that we face, that the last question about Beckham is a good one. I mean, if you just look at the body of information from the Garrison trial, you would probably get one view of Beckham. Now, if you go back and study Beckham from the rest of the full information about Beckham, his childhood, his enlistment with the Army, his going AWOL from the Army, look at his arrest records. Look at his, I mean, if you look at his full history, you have to consider his testimony in regard to his full history. You also have to consider it in regard to the rest of his activities in the period of 1962 through 1967, because you have to ask yourself, you know, if this is a person who was directly involved in why is he still around? I mean, what did he do in the interim? Did he just kind of wander off after becoming a courier and a primary courier from New Orleans to Dallas for the assassination, carrying down records and maps and that sort of thing? You know, did somebody just let him wander off? Oh, well, no. Let's look at the rest of his life. And that's what gets you into his involvement with Fred Chrisman. You have to look at Chrisman. Mm-hmm. You know, could he have really been part of this group, this mysterious group that Beckham talks about? Well, fortunately, I ended up researching Chrisman because of a UFO hoax that Chrisman did. It was a really tragic UFO hoax because it got people killed. Which you said, it's a classic in the UFO field as a hoax because it was fatal. It got investigators from the Army Air Force killed. Accidentally, not his fault, but long story short, what you find out is if you look at that full body of information, it's not just the claims that Beckham made. You have to have it in the full context of his life, his career, the fact that he and Chrisman both bought religious credentials. They both ran religious scams and various types of cons and continued to do so. I mean, after the assassination, you know, what serious conspiracy would let that go on? You know, it's okay. This guy was useful, and now we'll just to kind of show you the level that they operate at, they actually ran a scam in Washington State where they would put coin jars in bars collecting for charities.
Good.
And then just take the coin donations. So I guess what I'd like to wrap it up is not just to dump on that question, but it's so easy to become engaged in the mystery and the loose ends of what people say without, as we say over and over again, stepping back to look at the broader context to really say, does that make sense? I mean, what are the odds? What are the odds that they have made this up? Is it consistent with really anything suspicious they've done in the real world? Or on the other hand, is it consistent with falsehoods, scams, and misrepresentations that you find elsewhere in the world? So my wrap-up would be examine all of this stuff rather than just in the piece that's interesting to you in the broader context of information about the lead you're looking at.
Right, and I would say
Did that sound too preachy?
Nah, not at all. I would say also that Joan did a really serious effort when it came to getting Beckham's story down.
She did.
You know, and...
And he talked.
Very useful. He definitely shared a bunch of, whether it is factual or not is another story, but he definitely shared a lot of information as to how valid it is again, something that has to be judged against a whole lot of different things. But I would say that she did the better job than I would.
I can offer you one specific item there, which I can state. Mm-hmm. One of the claims that he made, and which he showed her a card, which could be interpreted as his having been trained in biochemical warfare. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, I had the same card because I was in the military, and what that means is they may have trained with a gas mask.
Right. No, I understand. Look, there's stuff like that where it does connect to the subject matter. I mean, and I've found that kind of thing before where it's like, look, I have this. And it's like, yeah, that's a military ID. They give that to everybody. You know what I mean? Now, there are different ways to find out about the guy. Do we know everything that could be known? I don't think so. But the stuff that we can get from his own mouth, I don't know, maybe that's already been done. What can I say about it? I've always had
He was a pretty good DJ. I mean, let's give kudos where they deserved. And he did have a job in New Orleans as a DJ, so we know that. But but anyway, that was just my picture always is you got to look for the big picture and you've got to examine all the details against the big picture before you reach a conclusion.
Mm-hmm. No, fair enough. So Larry, I hope I didn't make it too uncomfortable here with the questions and going into the directions we did. I think this was a useful discussion though, for sure. And somebody who is, look, if you're totally uninitiated in the case, this may not be something that you want to grab up right away. But if you've done some research for yourself and you've done some reading on the case, I think a lot of the discussion tonight could be, second level, second tier for sure, and useful to somebody who's trying to navigate that information. So we went there instead of getting our big focus on Lee Harvey Oswald. But sadly, the topic of Lee Harvey Oswald will be with us for a while, so we could always do that again in a couple of weeks. Right, Larry?
Yep. Absolutely. That one's going to stay there.
Yeah. And don't forget to give me that link, by the way, to that education forum thread where...
I will do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think that would be useful, too, because I've gotten questions about this before, and I got to say, I don't have any more than pretty much this guy sort of, disappears amongst the crowd at some point. I don't know anything else outside of that. A lot of other people we know exactly where they went, what they did afterwards, where they lived, who they married, everything. But some of these characters, yeah.
I will do that. This is not only, it's in-depth stuff, it's recent stuff, and you probably wouldn't have come across it. This gentleman just decided it was time to revisit Crawford, and he did. And quite frankly, I'll be honest, he introduces Crawford as a major player in the assassination. So that's where he's going. That motivated him to go deeply with it. But I'll get in and send you the link ASAP.
Great. But, you know, because here's the thing. When it comes to Crawford or Crawford or however it is you want to say it, I would not disqualify him out of hand. You know, there are various other characters that have been brought up as, we know that this person was a shooter and this and that. And I would not automatically discount this guy. Some of the others, I would.
I think one of the reasons I wouldn't discount him is I think, as with a couple of Ruby's girls, he was close enough to Jack to have known and have seen things that would have been very dangerous in any real investigation at the time. If I mean, as you know, Chuck, I'm absolutely one of those people that feels that Ruby was involved initially at a low level, but very much involved with the conspiracy and more so afterwards. And I put Crawford as one of those people that when they left town, they had a good reason for leaving town, and that was to, you know, get out of gunshot range.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing, is that, you know, being involved in that world, automatically, there might have been plenty of reasons for a guy like this to get out of town, too. I mean, I'm just saying, there's more than one purpose for possibly going, you know, think I've overstayed my welcome here in Dallas. And there were a bunch of guys like this. I mean, again, when I was trying to track down some of the organized crime stuff that, you know, is interesting there, and that sort of, you know, people automatically jump to, well, the Hunt family and, you know, and Marcello. And, yeah, you're not even looking at all the connective tissue. And when you do that, you find that there was stuff there that nobody wanted to see the light of day, even if the assassination didn't occur there. You know, the different businesses, let's say, that were going on. Not exactly stuff you want to advertise. And even organized crime figures wouldn't necessarily want that stuff to become known to anybody. This is the kind of business you do in the dark because it needs to stay in the dark to get done. Anyways.
Chuck, just one more sign-off thing. We got a minute. Just to elaborate on that point, and something I put in Someone Would Have Talked that really reinforces what you just said.
Sure.
There was a report that came out of the organized crime section of DPD. Never made it into the Warren Commission. I referenced the report that actually talked about an organized crime meeting at the carousel during off hours in the time frame that Crawford would have been there. And what becomes very dangerous about that is what you just said. It likely had nothing to do with the assassination, but it's one of those things, if it had really surfaced during the Warren Commission, Jack Ruby, organized crime in Dallas, you know, there's just lots of reason for people to start running for the exit.
Oh, yeah, and there were meetings that were held, you know, not just in Jack Ruby's clubs. That, you know, again, not like they keep minutes of this stuff or memos on it, right? But you know that some of this stuff happened in, you know, like, let's just say garages and let's just say, oh, other businesses after hours and not even just strip clubs. I mean, there is like a sort of sporting goods store where allegedly there were some meetings. There's a couple of restaurants, not while the restaurant was opened. There's some meetings. You know what I mean? That some other people talked about, and it's just like, well, yeah, we know this kind of thing was going on. Had to do with this or that. Had to do with maybe prostitution. Had to do with maybe pornography, because whatever. There were people from here or there that had to talk about some of this stuff. And there's a whole world of things going on that, again, maybe had nothing to do with the assassination, but some people that were maybe involved in some of those businesses could have been involved with some of the people who were key players in the assassination, you know? So it's, yeah, it's not just a cut and dry, black and white, one place or the other sort of thing. So always glad to talk about this kind of stuff with you, Larry Hancock. And of course, we went into a different direction, but I urge you to go in the direction of Larry-Hancock.com. Go there, check out his stuff, buy his books. Those are available on Amazon and all that. I'll give you guys links. Don't worry. Everything from unidentified to someone would have talked to surprise attack to shadow warfare to, I'm out of time. Larry Hancock, and also thanks to Mike Swanson for talking to us in the first hour. All you guys for calling and everybody for listening. I am Emilio Celli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.